Starless Night, Chapter 4, The Fire in Her Eyes. Catterby pulled her gray cloak about her to hide the dagger and masks she'd taken from Regis. Mixed feelings assaulted her as she neared Brunner's private chambers. She hoped both that the dwarf would be there and that he would not. How could she leave without seeing Brunner, her father, one more time? And yet, the dwarf now seemed to Catterby a shell of his former self, a wallowing old dwarf waiting to die. She didn't want to see him like that, didn't want to take that image of Brunner with her into the Underdark. She lifted her hand to knock on the door to Brunner's sitting room, then gently cracked the door open instead and peeked in. She saw a dwarf standing off to the side of the burning hearth, but it wasn't Brunner. Thibbledorf Puent, the battle rager, hopped about in circles, apparently trying to catch a pesky fly. He wore his razor-ridged armor, as always, complete with glove nails and knee and elbow spikes and other deadly points protruding from every plausible angle. The armor squealed as the dwarf spun and jumped, an irritating sound if Catterby had ever heard one. Puent's open-faced gray helm rested in the chair beside him, its top spike half as tall as the dwarf. Without it, Catterby could see the battle rager was almost bald. His remaining thin black strands of hair matted greasily to the sides of his head, then giving way to an enormous bushy black beard. Catterby pushed the door a little farther and saw Brunner sitting before the low-burning fire, absently trying to flip a log so that the embers would flare to life again. His half-hearted poke against the glowing log made Catterby wince. She remembered the days not so long ago when the boisterous king would have simply reached into the hearth and smacked the stubborn log with his bare hands. With a look to Puent, who was eating something that Catterby sincerely hoped was not a fly, the young woman entered the room, checking her cloak as she came in to see the items were properly concealed.
"Hey there!"
Puent howled between crunchy bites. Even more than her disgust at the thought that he was eating a fly, Catterby was amazed that he could be getting so much chewing out of it.
"You should get a beard,"
the battle rager cried, his customary greeting. From their first meeting, the dirty dwarf had told Catterby that she'd be a handsome woman indeed if she could only grow a beard.
"I'm working at it," Catterby replied, honestly glad for the levity. "You've got me promise that I haven't shaved me face since the day we met."
She patted the battle rager atop the head, then regretted it when she felt the greasy film on her hand.
"There's a good girl,"
Puent replied. He spotted another flitting insect and hopped away in pursuit.
"Where are you going?"
Brunner demanded sharply before Catterby could even say hello. Catterby sighed in the face of her father's scowl. How she longed to see Brunner's smile again. Catterby noted the bruise on Brunner's forehead, the scraped portion finally scabbing over. He had reportedly gone into a tirade a few nights before and had actually smashed down a heavy wooden door with his head while two frantic younger dwarves tried to hold him back. The bruise, combined with Brunner's garish scar, which ran from his forehead to the side of his jaw, across one socket where his eye had once been, made the old dwarf seem battered indeed.
"Where you going?"
Brunner asked again, angrily.
"Settlestone,"
the young woman lied, referring to the town of Barbarians, Wulfgar's people, down the mountain from Mithril Hall's eastern exit.
"The tribe's building the cairn to honor Wulfgar's memory."
Catterby was somewhat surprised at how easily the lie came to her. She'd always been able to charm Brunner, often using half-truths and semantic games to get around the blunt truth, but she'd never so boldly lied to him. Reminding herself of the importance behind it all, she looked the red-bearded dwarf in the eye as she continued,
"I'm wanting to be there before they start building. If they did do it, then they're to do it right. Wulfgar deserves no less."
Brunner's one working eye seemed to mist over, taking on an even duller appearance, and the scarred dwarf turned away from Catterby, went back to his pointless fire poking, though he did manage one slight nod of half-hearted agreement. It was no secret in Mithril Hall that Brunner didn't like talking of Wulfgar. He had even punched out one priest who had insisted that Aegis Fang could not, by dwarvish tradition, be given a place of honor in the Hall of Dumathoin, since a human, and no dwarf, had wielded it. Catterby noticed then that Puent's armor had ceased its squealing, and she turned about to regard the battle rager. He stood by the open door, looking forlornly at her and Brunner's back.
With a nod to the young woman, he quietly, for a rusted armored battle rager, left the room. Apparently, Caterbury was not the only one pained by the pitiful wretch Brunner Battlehammer had become.
"You've got their sympathy," she remarked to Brunner, who seemed not to hear.
"All in Mithril Hall speak kindly of their wounded king."
"Shut your face," Brunner said at the side of his mouth.
He still sat squarely facing the low fire. Caterbury knew that the implied threat was lame, another reminder of Brunner's fall. In days past, when Brunner Battlehammer suggested that someone shut his face, he did, or Brunner did it for him. But since the fights with the priest and with the door, Brunner's fire, like the one in the hearth, had played itself to its end.
"Do you mean to poke that fire the rest of your days?" Caterbury asked, trying to incite a fight, to blow on the embers of Brunner's pride.
"If it pleases me,"
the dwarf retaliated too calmly. Caterbury sighed again and pointedly hitched her cloak over the side of her hip, revealing the magical mask and Entreri's jeweled dagger. Even though the young woman was determined to undertake her adventure alone and did not want to explain any of it to Brunner, she prayed that Brunner would have life enough within him to notice. Long minutes passed, quiet minutes, except for the occasional crackle of the embers and the hiss of the unseasoned wood.
"I'll return when I return,"
the flustered woman barked, and she headed for the door. Brunner absently waved her away over one shoulder, never bothering to look at her. Caterbury paused by the door, then opened it and quietly closed it, never leaving the room. She waited a few moments, not believing that Brunner remained in front of the fire, poking it absently. Then she slipped across the room and through another doorway to the dwarf's bedroom. Caterbury moved to Brunner's large oaken desk, a gift from Wulfgar's people, its polished wood gleaming and designs of Aegis Fang, the mighty warhammer that Brunner had crafted, carved into its sides. Caterbury paused a long while, despite her need to be out before Brunner realized what she was doing, and looked at those designs, remembering Wulfgar. She would never get over that loss. She understood that. But she knew, too, that her time of grieving neared its end, that she had to get on with the business of living. Especially now, Caterbury reminded herself, with another of her friends apparently walking into peril. In a stone coffer atop the desk, Caterbury found what she was looking for, a small locket on a silver chain, a gift to Brunner from Elestriel, the Lady of Silvery Moon. Brunner had been thought dead, lost in Mithril Hall on the friend's first passage through the place. He had escaped from the halls some time later, avoiding the evil Grey Dwarves who had claimed Mithril Hall as their own, and, with Elestriel's help, he found Caterbury in Longsaddle, a village to the southwest. Drizzt and Wulfgar had left long before that, on their way south in pursuit of Regis, who had been captured by the assassin Entreri. Elestriel had given Brunner the magical locket. Inside was a tiny portrait of Drizzt, and with this device, the dwarf could generally track the drow. Proper direction and distance from Drizzt could be determined by the degrees of magical warmth emanating from the locket. The metal bauble was cool now, colder than the air of the room, and it seemed to Caterbury that Drizzt was already a long way from her. Caterbury opened the locket and regarded the perfect image of her dear drow friend. She wondered if she should take it. With Gwenhyber, she could likely follow Drizzt anyway, if she could get on his trail. And she kept it in the back of her mind that when Brunner learned the truth from Regis, the fire would come into his eyes and he would rush off in pursuit. Caterbury liked that image of fiery Brunner, wanted her father to come charging in to her aid and to Drizzt's rescue. But that was a child's hope, she realized, unrealistic and ultimately dangerous. Caterbury shut the locket and snapped it up in her hand. She slipped out of Brunner's bedroom and through his sitting room, with the red-bearded dwarf still seated before the fire, his thoughts a million miles away, then rushed through the halls of the upper levels, knowing that if she didn't get on her way soon, she might lose her nerve. Outside, she regarded the locket again, and knew that in taking it, she'd cut off any chances that Brunner would follow. She was on her own. That was how it had to be, Caterbury decided, and she slipped the chain over her head and started down the mountain, hoping to get to Silvery Moon not so long after Drizzt. He slipped as quietly and unobtrusively as he could along the dark streets of Mensa Barranzan, his heat-seeing eyes glowing ruby red. All that he wanted was to get back to Jarlaxle's base, back to the drow who recognized his worth.
"Wela Reville!"
came a shrill cry from the side. He stopped in his tracks, leaned wearily against the pile of broken stone near an unoccupied stalagmite mound. He had heard those words often before, always those two words said with obvious derision.
"Wela Reville!"
the drow female said again, moving toward him, a russet tentacle wand in one hand, its 3 8-foot-long arms writhing of their own accord, eagerly, as though they wanted to lash out with their own maliciousness and slap at him. At least the female wasn't carrying one of those whips of fangs, he mused, thinking of the multi-snake-headed weapons many of the higher-ranking drow priestesses used. He offered no resistance as she moved to stand right in front of him, respectfully lowered his eyes as Jarlaxle had taught him. He suspected that she, too, was moving through the streets inconspicuously. Why else would a drow female, powerful enough to be carrying one of those wicked rods, be crawling about the alleys of this, the lesser section of Mensa Baranzen? She issued a string of drow words in her melodic voice, too quickly for this newcomer to understand. He caught the words Quarth, which meant command, and Harilchik, or kneel, and expected them anyway, for he was always being commanded to kneel. Down he went, obediently and immediately, though the drop to the hard stone pained his knees. The drow female paced slowly about him, giving him a long look at her shapely legs, even pulling his head back so that he could stare up into her undeniably beautiful face, while she purred her name,
Jealous.
She moved as if to kiss him, then slapped him instead, a stinging smack on his cheek. Immediately, his hands went to his sword and dirk, but he calmed and reminded himself of the consequences. Still the drow paced about him, speaking to herself as much to him.
Iblith,
she said many times, the drow word for excrement, and finally he replied with a single word,
Aban,
which meant ally, again as Jarlaxle had coached him.
Aban del Darthir,
she cried back, smacking him again on the back of his head, nearly knocking him flat to his face. He didn't understand completely, but thought that Darthir had something to do with the fairies, the surface elves. He was beginning to figure out that he was in serious trouble this time, and would not so easily get away from this one.
Abanda Darthir!
Geralus cried again, and her tentacle rod, and not her hand, snapped at him from behind, all 3 tentacles pounding painfully into his right shoulder. He grabbed at the wound and fell flat to the stone, his right arm useless and the waves of pain rolling through him. Jarlis struck again at his back, but his sudden movement had saved him from the hit by all 3 of the tentacles. His mind raced. He knew that he had to act fast. The female kept taunting him, smacking her rod against the alley walls and every so often against his bleeding back. He knew for certain that he had caught this female by surprise, that she was on a mission as secret as his own, and that he would not likely walk away from this encounter. One of the tentacles slapped off the back of his head, dazing him. Still, his right arm remained dead, weakened by the magic of this simultaneous 3-strike. But he had to act. He moved his left hand to his right hip, to his dirk, then changed his mind and brought it around the other side.
Aban del Darthir!
Jarlis cried again, and her arm came forward. He spun about and up to meet it, his sword, not of drow make, flaring angrily as it connected with the tentacles. There came a green flash, and one tentacle fell free, but one of the others snaked its way through the parry and hit him in the face.
Jilvin!
The amused drow called for the word for play, and she elaborated most graciously, thanking him for his foolish retaliation, for making it all such fun.
"Play with this,"
he said back at her, and he came forward, straight ahead with the sword. A globe of conjure darkness fell over him.
"Jivin!"
Jarlis laughed again, and came forward to smack her with her rod. But this one was no novice in fighting dark elves, and, to the female's surprise, she did not find him within her globe. Around the side of the darkness he came, one arm hanging limp, but the other flashing this way and that in a marvelous display of swordsmanship. This was a drow female, though, highly trained in the fighting arts and armed with a tentacle rod. She parried and countered, scoring another hit, laughing all the while. She did not understand her opponent. He came in a straightforward lunge again, spun about to the left as if to continue with a spinning overhand chop, then reversed his grip on the weapon, pivoted back to the right, and heaved the sword as though it were a spear. The weapon's tip dived hungrily between the surprised female's breasts, sparking as it sliced through the fine drow armor. He followed the throw with a leaping somersault and kicked both feet forward so that they connected on the quivering sword hilt, plunging the weapon deeper into the malevolent female's chest. The drow fell back against the rock pile, stumbling over it until the uneven wall of the stalagmite supported her at a half-standing angle, her red eyes locked in a wide stare.
"A pity, jealous,"
he whispered into her ear, and he softly kissed her cheek as he grasped the sword hilt and pointedly stepped on the writhing tentacles to pin them down on the floor.
"What pleasures we might have known."
He pulled the sword free and grimaced as he considered the implications of this drow female's death. He couldn't deny the satisfaction, however, at taking back some of the control in his life. He hadn't gone through all his battles just to wind up a slave. He left the alley a short while later, with Jairless and her rod buried under the stones, and, with a bounce, returned to his step.